Wow, it's great to see so many people here. What is it about investigative journalism? I don't know, there's some kind of zeitgeist going on. I'm Rosie Waterhouse, not Rose. I'm a freelance journalist, but I've worked for 5 national newspapers and Newsnight. But here, and I also developed an MA in investigative journalism. So I guess that's why I've been asked to chair this. We've got 3 really distinguished journalists whose specialty is investigating, digging, long-term projects. I'm going to start with Alice. Alice Ross, former student of mine, star student of mine, it has to be said, from the Bureau of Investigative Journalism. Started at the Bureau, I believe, the day you left the course?
The Monday after.
Yeah, great stuff. And team leader of the drones project. Mark Watts, XRO, is that how you pronounce it?
That's right.
News, very innovative, investigative website, breaking stories, just been shortlisted for the Orwell Prize, one of the Orwell Prizes. Solomon Hughes, Private Eye. What can I say? One of the most wonderful publications there is, and if anyone here is a journalism student, I can recommend it. It's essential reading. You'll find so many stories there. So I think, Solomon, would you start us off?
I will indeed, just for pressure of time, that's why I stood up, just so we could get it going quickly. I've realised I've written my piece of paper here. My name is Solomon Hughes, in case I forgot there, obviously, but I am. I'm principally a reporter for Private Eye, but I do bits of freelance for some of the nationals as well. I'm going to talk a bit about those as well, because I think they show the context a bit. If I tell you about how it works at Private Eye, that just tells you how it works at Private Eye, which is unlike the rest of the press, so it doesn't really give you a broader sense of it, of some of the barriers to investigative reporting. So I'm going to talk about stories outside of Private Eye, but you just have to imagine, when I talk about the problems, just put in brackets in your head, except at Private Eye. These barriers don't exist there. Now, a lot of the things, I'm going to talk about some quite shallow investigative reporting, just quite a shallow dig, because the point is, I mean, I've done deeper stories, but some of the stories I'm going to do here, A, for pressure of time, and B, to make a point, they're not that complicated, but the fact that I can make a bit of a living doing that shows that there's a weakness of investigative reporting in the national press. There's some really good stuff. I don't know, did anyone go to James Dean's thing on PPI this morning? That's a really good story. There's loads of really good stories, but it's very uneven. There's a real problem with there's not enough investigative reporting in the national press. And the fact that I can pitch, you know, basically fairly straightforward stories shows that. Right, so here's a nice simple story in The Independent quite recently. Former Tory minister Charles Henry to be consultant to Russian-linked oil firms. So are there going to be sanctions on Russia over Ukraine? Well, not if recent Tory ministers get their way, because he's gone working for a firm, Vitoil. It's an oil trader with huge deals with Rosneft and Gazprom, state oil firms. Pretty straightforward story in The Independent, me and Tom Harper there. How I found it, it's not complicated. You just check the Register of Members' Interests, MPs' Interests, published every fortnight during sessions, term time for MPs. This is actually a screenshot that you probably, people at the front will see this, people at the back won't, but it's a screenshot of his interests. And I didn't highlight that in yellow. They highlight it in yellow, the new entries. So, I mean, how hard is that? He says he's going to work for Vitoil. Obviously, it relies on some business knowledge. You'd have to think, for the people at the back can't see, it says, Charles Henry, I've got a new job at Vitol, 60 grand. That's not a hard story. There's some business knowledge you'd want in there. Vitol should ring bells to anyone with any business knowledge. Vitol were prosecuted for kickbacks to Saddam Hussein's government, bribing Saddam Hussein's government. It's meant to be the other way around, isn't it? They avoided sanctions on oil for Iran. So that should ring bells. But even if it didn't, you could just, when I first started in the late 90s, I would just check those things. Ooh, who are Vitol? And in this case, the issue which I wasn't so conscious of came up, that they had these big Russian deals. So that's it. That's a fairly straightforward story. But the fact that I could make a few quid doing that and get my name out shows there's a weakness of investigative reporting in the national press there. My strength, their weakness is what I'm saying. I'll just grab some water, actually. It's hard to see those things, yeah. Because
yeah.
I'll just talk you through them anyway. And some of them are not so tiny. That's the problem with screenshots, isn't it? Really. There's another issue about difficulty of getting investigative reporting in the national press. It's all about news values, and in news values, the structure of news, there's Westminster correspondence and there's the business correspondence, and they kind of go through the news desk. If you're freelancing with something and if you hear the word news desk, for me it always kills a story. The news desk are like a filter that stops really interesting stories for some reason. I don't know why. There's these two groups, Westminster correspondents and business correspondents. The Westminster correspondents know about Westminster personalities, in the way of personalities, who's up, who's down, and the business desk knows about business. But the two don't seem to communicate, so the vital story just falls in the middle there. That's a weakness to do with news values. It's an advantage to me. To be honest, all the weaknesses in the national press are great for our three careers. You know, they're good for us, but they're bad for you. This is a shame, this weakness, this news values weakness, because our Prime Minister David Cameron gave a speech just before coming into office saying that the next big scandal waiting to happen was the relationship between business and industry, lobbying, ministers getting jobs with private companies like Charles Henry did as soon as Cameron became Prime Minister. So if the Prime Minister says this is the next big scandal, you would think people would pay attention, but it's actually somewhat underreported. It's also, I think, it's present in the popular culture. Oh, semi-popular. Do other people watch Salamander?
Yes.
Excellent, isn't it? Yeah, is it just old people, isn't it? Because we like box sets, because the young people are out enjoying themselves. Absolutely. There you go. But again, we're stuck inside. But who else watches Salamander? No one? It's a detective show, but Salamander is a secret organisation, and this is a quote from the show. It's a sort of interest group. They arrange appointments to high office and ensure each other's companies win government contracts. Now, obviously, in the show, they also all shoot each other and sleep with each other, whereas in the real world, they just sleep with each other. So, but it's in the popular consciousness, or in Homeland Series. Who's watched Homeland Series 3? Excellent. It's the bank, HLBC, is the corrupt bank involved in sanctions busting with Iran. So, you know, what I'm saying is this conflict is there. It's in the bloody telly. It's in the Prime Minister's mouth. But it is in the newspapers, but not enough, or I wouldn't have a job. News values, again, simplicity. The news likes simplicity. Here's a story I did. Another Tory MP, Gerald Howarth, ex-minister, stopped being a minister, took a job with QuickQuid, payday lender. Will the government regulate payday lenders? No, because they're all going to get jobs with them, is the story there. How I find that, Register of Members' interests, again, a bit bigger for those with at the back or with poor eyesight. His new job was as a consultant to CNU Online Holdings LLC Innova of Chicago. Now, some digging, not very deep. I had to get the annual report of that company and figure out that they own QuickQuid, the payday lender. I mean, to be honest, it's got a bloody sign on it, hasn't it? It's got a flashing light. Why is the MP for Aldershot working for a company in Chicago? Something's wrong. Have a look. So, but unfortunately, just that slight kind of weirdness there adds a bit of complexity. So in the story, this is the actual story, you have to have a line that says... QuickQuid, the British subsidiary of CNU Holdings, to which Sir Gerald Howarth is contracted. And it's that little bit of... The Independent were OK with that, that's no problem. But it's just that funny awkwardness that breaks up the story. And if you go for something bigger, some bigger piece of lobbying, or more complex piece of lobbying, typically it's going to involve proxies, intermediaries, it's going to be heavily disguised, and that makes reporting difficult because the news value is simplicity. I think for us three, we rely on our readers having a high tolerance for complexity, but unfortunately, not all news that's not always the news value. So that's a kind of barrier. Again, it made a job for me, but it's a problem in the news. The next news value is sexiness. Sexy news. This is a story from the Daily Mail, quite an old one now. Tory donor snaps up Olympic Village at a knockdown price, and it's costing you £275 million. Jamie Rittblatt, he's from a long-standing business family, gave 50 million to the 50,000, sorry, to the Tories, and then won this contract for, to buy the Olympic Village when the Olympics were over at a huge loss to the public. In this story, Daily Mail story, there's a code word which you can spot in the newspapers. It says, it was only this week that it emerged. How does a story emerge? What that means is I did a story in Private Eye the week before and then they stole it. That's what emerging means. Emerging means someone else did the story first. How did I do the story? I went to the website of the Electoral Commission. You can do this. And then this tab here says look up donations. And then there's a search page that's sort of awkward and a bit hard to use. But a couple of tries and you get to use it. You can search by name or minimum value and party. That's quite important. So I did the search and then you can see the search. For those who can read it, it says Delancey Retail Estate Asset Management. It was 50 grand to the Tories. This is from the Tory Party website. The leaders group, you can join the leaders group of the Conservative Party for £50,000. And if you do, it's, I quote, the premier support group of the Conservative Party. Members are invited to join David Cameron and other senior figures from the Conservative Party at dinners, post-PMQ launches. What do I do with that? Quit that. Yeah, there you go. You get to meet David Cameron for 50 quid. That's our salamander. It's not a secret group. It's on a bloody website. And it's checks payable 50 grand to Salamander Incorporated. So that's a clue, actually. You should always search the Electoral Commission website for payments of 50 grand because they met Cameron. So that's how the story is done. And it worked because it's the sexy news value is the Olympics. Because the Olympics was on the telly. It allows you to have pictures of muscly young people glistening in the sun. And it's another story that exists that you're tying onto. Whereas this story, unsexy news. These are all a bit small. But this is the website of the Advisory Committee on Business Appointments, which a regulator which regulates MPs. So it regulates ministers' new jobs with industry when they leave being a minister. It's a toothless regulator, which is great for journalists because it publishes the truth but doesn't do anything about it, so we can just write a moaning story. And it showed that Lord Strathclyde, former cabinet minister, had got a new job with URS Corporation. And that's not sexy, because who are URS Corporation? And, you know, that's boring, isn't it, really? But, of course, URS Corporation, a big American contractor, who are running Sellafield, the nuclear site that used to be called Windscale for people of a certain age, and they're running it really badly. It's a £1 billion disaster, but their contract was renewed shortly after they gave Lord Strathclyde a job. But that's unsexy because there's no muscly people. It's not on the telly anyway. It's not in the south. It's in the north. So that's unsexy news. That's news values. Obviously, we do that story in Private Eye. Shall I keep rattling on, or how am I doing for time here?
Can we just sort of interrupt a bit?
Yeah.
Come back to some of your stories,
sure.
Because that's what was going to be one of my questions. Tell us about some of your scoops. But Alice, can we go to you? Give your introduction about so you're here to talk about using new techniques alongside traditional skills to dig for stories. So tell us about your work.
Well, is this on? So I work for the Bureau of Investigative Journalism, and we are a non-profit, philanthropically funded news agency. So it's in the model of ProPublica in the United States. Our longest running project, which we've been at for nearly 3 years now, is a sort of gigantic sprawling database tracking drone strikes in Pakistan, Yemen, and Somalia. I was just listening to Solomon talking about sexy versus non-sexy news, and I'm never sure where drones fall into that whole spectrum. They seem to get a lot of fascination from people. They really capture the imagination. But actually what we're concerned with is targeted killing, which is slightly separate from drones. Basically, there are two key uses for drones. They can be used on the battlefield alongside other military equipment. So, for example, in Afghanistan, in Libya, in Iraq. Or, since 2002, the US has also been carrying out secret drone bombing raids in Pakistan, Yemen, and Somalia. And it's those that we're interested in. So by summer 2011, the campaign for bombing in Pakistan was 7 years in, and it was basically an open secret. President Obama had launched more than 200 drone strikes, and yet, you know, without real official discussion of this program, there was a real tendency towards selective transparency, selective discussion, and that remains the case very much. You know, you get senior U.S. officials going on the record saying these drones are so accurate they haven't killed a single civilian in the past year. I mean, that is a very easy claim to test. So we set out to, you know, reports of civilian casualties were not hard to find. So we set out to aggregate and to come up with a sort of methodologically robust way of measuring and of testing these claims. And we spent months essentially drawing together all of the information that we could find that was in the public domain. That was our starting point. You know, I mean, we're talking about secret bombings, but they're not, it's very hard to do a bombing in secret, basically. They do get reported on. So we pulled together all of the information that we could find, and we assembled it into a sort of, into a very low-tech database of drone strikes and of casualties. And then that allowed us to then zoom in and highlight strikes that we felt were of particular concern. Our starting point was that claim that there had been no civilian deaths in the past year. I mean, that was easy. We identified 10 individual strikes, and we got local reporters to go out and investigate those strikes. And we found that there were over 200 civilians, there were reports of over 200 civilian deaths. Obviously, it's very, very hard to empirically test these things, but there were credible indications, credible evidence of over 200 civilians killed to that point. And we were able to put together and publish a database, transparently sourced, showing the evidence that supported these claims, and adding our own field investigation to that. Solomon was just talking about the very careful language that you end up having to use, and certainly our readers are very used to, you know, these are, you know, reports of civilian deaths, there's, you know, all of those sort of disclaimers come in. And at the end of the day, the American government does categorically deny the claims that there are several hundred civilians who've been killed in drone strikes. They will dismiss those claims as ludicrous. All we can do is put together the evidence and present it to people as transparently as we can, really. What do you do with that database once you've got it? We've used it as a basis for our own investigations. We've used it to explore trends and tactics that have been used. Almost 3 years on, we've expanded into Yemen and into Somalia. And just the very process of tending that data, sort of maintaining it and updating it, and, you know, really adding to our understanding of each strike, takes my colleague Jack, who's just there. It's basically a full-time job for him. It provides an evidence base with which you can scrutinise all of the official claims, and every now and then people do still make claims, you know, for example, there's been fewer than 10 single digit casualties in every year of the drone campaign. Well, we can look at our stuff and question that, really. And also, what the databases that we put together, they've also acted as a resource for other media organisations, and in some senses that's probably the most important aspect of our work, really, is informing the debate, providing an evidential foundation on which others can sort of report on this extremely complex national security area. I guess the things that we've used, haven't been very technologically sophisticated at all. It's just required a lot of time, a lot of attention to detail, and a sort of real methodological rigour. And that's what we've done.
Fantastic. Thanks, Alice.
Hey, Mark, will you tell us about Exaro News and your introduction to it, and we'll have more questions for everyone later.
Well, certainly. I actually think these are very exciting times for journalism, and in particular, very exciting times for investigative journalism. And that's not something you very often hear people say, and it's certainly not something you hear an investigative journalist say very often. And the reason for it is also somewhat surprising. It's in reaction to what's gone before. Solomon talked about the shortcomings, shall we say, of our industry on the whole, and I can only endorse them to a great degree. But in particular, we've had the rise of what has been dubbed churnalism, which is the practice of whichever category you fit in, whether you're a Westminster correspondent or a business correspondent, of sitting in a desk, sitting at a desk in an office that resembles a bank, and rewriting press releases, or possibly attending a press briefing in which someone's going to give you a load of old nonsense, which you're going to report as if it might be true. So we've had churnalism, and it really turns off readers, in my view. What we've also had, and we've had the exposure of, is dark arts, the use of techniques that are not really investigative, not really the right techniques for investigative journalists to use, but are shortcuts. And the big baddie behind all this, I can tell you, is the accountant. It is the accountant's mentality that said it's a very good idea to have journalists working in serried ranks behind desks as if they were working in a bank and rewriting press releases. And they also thought it would be a good idea that if we're going to do anything vaguely investigative, then let's do the surefire bet of hacking phones and raiding bins. What's come out of this is a sense that we have to do things differently, and it might well be, to some degree, returning to what was done a long time ago, and that is real journalism. And we're seeing a rise, I think, of new organisations springing up left, right and centre in America, in the UK, and indeed continental Europe, which are practising real journalism. So XRO is an example of one of these new-ish organisations. We were launched 2.5 years ago. XRO is an investigative website which publishes often long-running investigations. It will do some shallow ones as well from time to time, quick hits, a little bit of digging, but more often than not, there's a lot of digging involved, and we're often reporting to a degree as we go along, which is something of an innovation. In times gone by, you would sit there and spend a year or two working on a well-done action, and then eventually you would produce it. We tend to sort of investigate and produce stories as we go along. Now, in terms of some of the stories that XRO has broken, we were responsible for uncovering the extraordinary practice of senior civil servants working for all sorts of Whitehall departments and agencies, but not being on the payroll. And they had a very clever little ruse which involved setting up a personal service company for each and every one of them and being paid through the personal service company. And it was a very useful device to avoid paying tax. Now, this was a story that initially we were tipped off about. It was our Westminster correspondent, who doesn't spend all his time sat at a desk. He was in a pub, which is where he should be. And a mole told him about this extraordinary practice. And the mole, in particular, said it was a practice at the Department of Business Innovation and Skills, but said it was widespread throughout Whitehall. Well, of course, you can't run a story on a single source in a pub, no matter how good the source was, and it was a very good source. And we started digging at that point. And we were using open access techniques. We were using Freedom of Information Act in particular. Now, because we had an inside source, we were directed towards a particularly what we were told was a stark case concerning a guy called Ed Lester, who was chief executive of the student loans company. And so we started digging around, making FOIA requests for material that surrounds his contract and his contract negotiations. And as often happens with FOIA, Freedom of Information, we were rebuffed. But because we had an inside source, we were guided as to how to slightly amend our requests until one day a great wreath of documents landed on a desk that our Westminster correspondent doesn't spend that much time sitting at. And then we started going through it, and it set out the story very clearly. It was a bit complicated. This is often the way with the world. But nonetheless, it was clear enough. The guy had been paid and had pressed to be paid through his personal service company, which was a device that could save him tens of thousands of pounds. Now, we did that as a one-off story. We did it initially with Newsnight. We often work with mainstream media organisations. We work with television news programmes as well as national newspapers. And the story did have an immediate effect. There was an emergency debate in the Parliament the next day. Everyone could see it was an outrageous scandal. And Danny Alexander, then still Chief Secretary to the Treasury, ordered a review. And the review looked into how widespread this practice was. And because we're pretty good with our inside sources, we, of course, got to find out the results of that before that was published. And it turned out staggeringly that there were more than 2,000 of these civil servants, senior civil servants, working on that basis. And the story has gone on from there. We just recently uncovered another chief executive of another government agency who is doing the same thing. And so far, we are aware of about 125 civil servants who have been reported to the HMRC for possible tax evasion. So real consequences that flowed from that exposure. We have done quite a lot around sort of bribery and corruption surrounding defence contracts that British companies have overseas. One of our investigations resulted in the Serious Fraud Office launching a criminal investigation. Not that they take these things terribly seriously and are not exactly working assiduously. And similarly, we've been investigating a series of high-profile people who we have so far not named over allegations of child sex abuse, and caused one specific criminal investigation known as Operation Fernbridge to start as a result of our work in that area. But broadly, the way XRO works is traditional journalistic methods, our guys in pubs up and down the land, Belfast, in Westminster, wherever it may be, Brussels, and then using open access laws in every which way. I mean, I'm using open access here in a very wide context, so it's not just freedom of information. It covers, you know, disclosures made to select committees, things like register of members' interests, all these sort. There are so many sources out there that can be consulted. And in particular, we have developed a sort of arm of data journalism, which is very focused on taking advantage, if you like, or exploiting the tentative steps that the government is making towards what it calls transparency, not necessarily what I would call transparency, but actually, in fairness, they are making steps along this road. And in particular, they are increasingly making basic data available. And I think the vague idea is that we're going to have an army of armchair auditors going through this data, complete fantasy land, it's complete nonsense. What journalists can do, if they are willing to spend some time not just rewriting press releases or practicing the dark arts, is actually getting a handle on this data and making sense of it and reporting on it. And one of the particularly innovative things that we're doing is we're approaching this sort of analysis of data to both produce stories, editorial content, while at the same time producing data products that have commercial value. So XRO is unusual in that its aim in the long run is to be a self-financing a commercial operation, and the real route that we're using for a revenue driver is the sale of add-on data services that is almost a byproduct of our data journalism. And beyond that, we of course do a lot of tie-ups with existing mainstream media. And one of the things I would say about, I mean, I've heard The Independent mention, but it's true of lots of other papers, red top tabloids as well as broadsheets, is often the journalists working there would love to be doing this stuff, and they really like to work with us because it becomes a bit more practical, where we've probably done the bulk of the legwork, and they will just sort of write it perhaps in a slightly different way because they're quite good at rewriting things. That's what they mostly do after all. And even then, they don't often even bother with that, because often with these stories that are quite complicated, a key thing is trying to encapsulate what is the essence of a story that will take hold. So, for example, the idea of senior civil servants working in a way that enables them to avoid tax, that did take hold. It wasn't. It might have been complicated at root, but the basic idea was quite simple. So I would urge you to keep watching out for this great material that we're putting out through extranews.com and with people in the mainstream media with whom we work.
The format of this is supposed to be introductions and a bit of a conversation and then Q&A. I want to leave lots of time for Q&A, so I think we'll keep the conversation quite short. But one of the reasons I was interested to chair this is that the title is Three Very Different Investigative Journalists Talk About How They Are Using New Techniques Alongside Traditional Skills to Dig for Stories. And this is where my course comes in, the MA Investigative Journalism, which is quite niche, specialist, 2022 students, where essentially I developed this course, which is to use methods and sources old and new. So I am the old, starting out on a weekly newspaper. I'm doing the really traditional route of digging and shoe leather journalism and going to the pub and getting stories. But I realise that today's generation of journalists has to have all the new skills. So I bring in people to teach things like computer-assisted reporting, advanced research skills. So I wanted to ask Alice, who's one of my protégés, if you like, can you tell us about the methods and sources old and new? How do you, in some detail of particularly explaining the fundamentals that you rely on as a journalist, but then all the new whizzy stuff and social media and data and everything that's out there, this tsunami of information that you deal with?
There is an absolute tsunami of information. I wouldn't say that any of our methods are particularly whizzy or sophisticated. They're all to do with devising a method of dealing with all of the information, a method of assembling data and then applying it as rigorously as you can. So our primary sources are, you know, open source media reports, court testimonies, NGO field investigations, information from our own field researchers. And you bring all of that together and it's like a jigsaw puzzle. You're trying to put together a picture of each drone strike. A lot of the time as well, particularly in Yemen, reports will emerge from social media, from Twitter. And they're the challenges of, you know, those old skills of verification. You know, how do I trust this source? How do I trust what they're telling me? Those challenges are, they're at once new and old. You know, and you can use new techniques. You can look at who they're talking to on Twitter. But, I mean, they're just variations on very long-established sort of methods, aren't they, really? So we're taking sort of news reports and all these other sources, speaking to our own sources to see how it squares, whether it passes the smell test, really, a lot of the time, and then boiling that all into data. And I mean, even the databases that we use, they're not sophisticated. It's all about keeping it really quite simple. You know, if you're putting together data, it's very different from if you're getting a government database and interrogating it yourself. You know, we are assembling the data ourselves based on news reports, so it's sort of...
So you mentioned Twitter, my friend Twitter. I must be one of the few left generation who don't tweet. I was taught how to tweet, and I have posted one tweet which said, "Thank you very much for this lesson." But I realise, as a journalist, I mean, I don't need to. You know, I teach it. I do my own freelancing, using my own sources and methods, very old-fashioned. But I realise that my students, all journalists, need to tweet now. But Solomon, I wonder, do you have a view about Twitter?
Oh yeah, I'm against that. That's well bad. There's a Ian Hislop in Twitter, but look, it isn't him. And every now and then he likes to say, "Oh, that's not me," and just assume it is. I'm at Solomon's right. I do, and it's because you have to generate profile. I don't really get anything from it, to be honest. I think. Because it's for free, and the private eye model is that if you buy our magazine for £1.60 or take out subscription, we'll use that money to pay writers. And I think all the social media stuff, all the Twitter stuff, is like, will you now go and do it for free and promote yourself? Which journalists, you have to do, teaching someone to start their career, they've got to do it. But I just think it's an imposition. It's like being your own intern. It's the nice part. In terms of new methods, I mean, to be honest, a lot, you used to have to go to companies' house to get annual reports, and you have to sit in this funny little room in London.
Great.
And now, for £1, you get it over the web. So it's the same thing, but actually it's much quicker. Mm-hmm. I mean, that side can be much quicker. The law and the Register of Lords interest, you have to go to the, not to see the full register, but to see little addenda to it. You have to go to the House of Lords and meet some official, I can't remember, who was like in a, you know, fancy dress and opened a little file. And that's, you know, so those things are gone. In terms of social media, the one I find is the most useful is LinkedIn, actually. Because people put their CV on LinkedIn and they put themselves in their best light and tell you about all their contacts and that. And that's actually more useful, I think, than Facebook, because if people are sensible, they set their security things right, you know, and you feel a bit creepy looking at people's Facebook pages anyway. And also because the associations you can see on it, I think, if you think about your own Facebook friends, I don't know that tells you, know, I've got people who I'm friends with who I don't really like, you know, so I don't think that always tells you things.
We found, like, FBI agents complete CVs and who they're married to and things like that on LinkedIn. Yeah. It's amazing the information that people put on there.
I mean, in a way, we shouldn't be saying that now.
Probably not.
It's a good source.
Yeah.
Yeah, I would.
And then I think we should open it up to questions.
On social media, first of all, I am absolutely against anyone thinking of the idea of doing any journalism or any writing without being paid. Don't do it. I'm glad of that reaction. So coming back to Twitter specifically, actually, I think with all these things, they all have a use from a journalistic point of view. And actually the main use that I've seen, not just me personally, but members of my team for Twitter, is just a way of people out there contacting you, people coming forward. One of the things that I say we find from doing writing stories, as in the sense we're investigating, which is true of all of our biggest stories, whether it's the Rupert Murdoch exposure for his secret recordings or the tax Whitehall tax scandal or the VIP paedophile story, we get people coming forward, and Twitter is a kind of common way. There's the phone still, and there's still email and other methods, but Twitter is another route. So all these things have their uses, and as a journalist, as a practicing journalist, you just need to know everything. You need to know how to use Compass House, and you need to know how to use it now. You need to know how to access documents that have been filed in the High Court. That's a real palaver. You can't do that online yet. But whatever it is, you just need to know. How do you find registered members' interests? All the rest of it. How do you find someone's CV through LinkedIn and so on and so forth? You just need every single one of these techniques to combine, whether they're new or old, and you have to use them all and you have to know them all.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, let's have questions. I think we're over on too long, but okay, you at the front.
To what extent do you think it's true that newspapers concentrate more on politicians' misdemeanors than on, people in the city, big business, and their misdemeanors?
Well,
and why do you think, if that's true, why do you think that is?
I can tell you. I mean, I used to work for a business newspaper called Sunday Business and ran the investigations unit there. And business journalists are almost as bad as showbiz journalists, who are almost as bad as political journalists, for just listening to the spin doctors and being manipulated by the PR guff. And maybe I've got the order slightly wrong. It's probably political journalists, showbiz journalists, and then business journalists, getting worse as I went along. Business is a bit complicated, people find it, especially journalists. A lot of journalists are completely innumerate, which is not good, and don't understand anything about business. If you can't add up, it makes it quite difficult to understand anything about business. So it's especially easy to pull the wool over journalists' eyes in that area. Business journalism is an area where PRs reign supreme. Stories are given like favours. It works in the political world like this too, but especially in the business world, because business journalists have got no idea what they're doing on the whole. Of course, there are the occasional exception. And it meant that, coming back in a way to Solomon's point earlier, it's great for us if you're actually willing to go digging, because there's just so much to go for. And when I ran the investigations unit at Sunday Business, it was just amazing, the stories that were going begging. And it'd often be stuff that was based on court documents that you'd have to find, or obscure employment tribunals where you'd find out about the widespread cocaine practices of senior bankers or whatever, and we did name banks, and I remember a bank going absolutely ballistic. I won't name it because I think I might be forgetting the exact details, so I won't name it now, but they went absolutely ballistic and couldn't understand how this story had possibly surfaced, and other publications were scared of it, but it was all in privileged documents. It was in court documents that we could happily, fairly and accurately report. So business journalism is really hopeless.
One thing I would say on that is I think there's also a sort of a structural way that journalism works that it's personality driven, and so politicians are personalities, businesses are faceless corporate structures. Now in private eye, to some extent, we just did the story anyway, but in a little way you try to make the business a personality to get through that. So Atos, who do the crappy testing of people for disability benefits and are always horrible, we always couldn't give a toss, we just do that all the time. Or Capita, the privatising, we always called Crapita, and you just try and make them a personality to get round that. I mean, I started, one of the earliest big breakthroughs I made was with Enron, covering Enron's activities in this country, and they were just rotten. There's another side to it, which is kind of a simple thing, is that if a politician is bribed, they will talk about the bribe, they'll talk about the person who received the bribe but not the person who gave it, which I think is partly that personality driven thing, and it's, I don't know, it's partly, I don't know, just an assumption well, almost there was a legal, it was actually, it's no longer the case, but there was a point where it was illegal for a company to bribe people, and you could even claim tax relief from it. That stopped about a decade ago, maybe, but it was illegal to receive a bribe. So there's that was built into the structures of capitalism, actually, or law. But yeah, I think that personality thing is another thing, which there's a way around it. It's not a great way, but to try and make the business kind of personality, which is why Fat Cat is the one bad corporate misbehaviour that becomes a story, because it's made a personality. It's that kind of cartoon approach.
Okay, I caught your eye. Purple jumper, is it Jack?
Yeah. No,
here.
Ah.
Sorry, we just need it for filming purposes.
Through lights.
Yeah.
Yeah, Jack Searle. I work with Alice on the Drones Project at the Bureau of Investigative Journalism, which is, as she said, a non-profit, so it's something of an ivory tower. It's a very fortunate position to be in. Private Eye bucks all trends in print by making money, and I'm not entirely sure how XRO is funded, but you're clearly funded well enough to be able to keep doing what you're doing as well as you do. First question is it routine investigative journalism destined to end up in places like the Bureau, Private Eye and XRO, and not on the pages of national papers and so forth? And second question is, and Alice sort of touched upon this when she was talking about using new techniques, basically the old techniques, but a bit more swish. I mean, they make the old techniques easier. And do you think these are then going to mean that we can have people working as freelancers or something on investigative stories, whereas before it would take you months and you'd have to find some way of making the money? Now it takes much less time and you don't have to support yourself through other means in order to get these great investigations out.
What was the second question? Crisply, please.
Crisply. New techniques make old techniques easier.
Question mark?
No, I think that's true. Do you think that is going to enable people to do investigations, and is that going to mean we're going to see a grand golden age of investigative journalism once again? Question mark.
Yes.
Yes. So the first question was, is the mainstream media going to basically give up with investigative journalism? Have they already done so? Well, they haven't entirely. I think it's easy to exaggerate the position. There isn't a great deal of it that goes on, but it clearly does go on. You have to remember that the phone hacking scandal, which was a scandal in our own industry, was actually, I'm glad to say, exposed by our own industry, and that was principally The Guardian leading the charge on that one. I think things are changing in the sense that new organisations are springing up, and I'm very conscious in talking to editors of papers or programmes that they're very conscious of us and what we can do. And they, as I suppose they have increasing difficulties over their resource, they're seeing someone like us as a partial solution to that problem. So although, of course, we are paid by them, but rather than have a small army of investigative journalists working away possibly hopelessly in the middle of a quarter of a newsroom, they can sort of use us as and when we come up with stuff. I mean, sometimes they commission us to do stuff, but broadly we'll just work on investigations that we decide we want to do, and we're going to publish them anyway if we find a story, whether or not we find a partner to do it with. But invariably very often we do find someone to do it with, and they'll pay us. Whether that necessarily reflects the true cost of if they had done it themselves is probably another question. So I think that balance is changing. I don't think The Guardian's going to stop doing Snowden stuff. I hope they don't. And but nonetheless, we're going to carry on doing our VIP paedophile stuff and our non-tax civil servants and things we've got in the pipeline. The landscape is changing.
Solomon, golden age, new techniques make old methods easier, faster?
They do. I mean, like the not having to go to company's house. I mean, it's just as much as that. This makes things much quicker. But so I find it slightly disappointing amongst the voluntary sector, so to speak, that when you look at people setting up independent blogs and things like that, generally speaking, they just redirect you back to a newspaper story. But the amount of people who actually say, I've got these company documents and they show why is pretty minimal. You find other outside bodies, the Bureau of Investigative Journalism, doing that, and also WikiLeaks, and obviously they're just destroyed themselves, I suppose, in the end, but they didn't make an incredible impact. The GMB I saw recently did a great story for The Mirror, where they did all the research. There's a story on the front page of The Mirror about how Prince Charles gets housing benefit because it's his estate. It was a freedom of information based story, local authority by local authority. Ask every local authority who's your main recipient of housing benefit, because if you're unemployed, the benefit doesn't go to you, it goes literally directly. And they found, well, Prince Charles, the Crown Estate and the Duchy of Lancaster was there. But it was the GMB that did the research. I mean, it's a great Mirror story, but the GMB did the research for them. There's room for it, there's a hunger for it, the papers will cover for it, but they won't put enough resource into it, so I worry we'll become like a niche. It's like British engineering is now a niche luxury industry, so now we're a niche luxury industry. Private eyes like the old cranky one, we're like a Brompton bike. You're like a bit more modern, so you're like a Lessie or maybe Dyson or something like that. You're like a sort of engineering department in a university because you're funded by, you know, like that. And so we're like we become this sort of niche luxury. That would be my worry. Whereas really, I mean, I've very rarely worked in the tabloids, and it's always a disappointment to me because when they do go for something, they go for it and they hit harder. They go for punch. But it's that's what would worry me, is that it should happen, but it's not happening, and we're all becoming a bit niche and luxury, and
But one of the things that we're doing at Extra is very much working with mainstream media,
yeah.
So, and including red top tabloids even. And you're right, if they decide to go for a story, they'll go for it, and it will have real impact. Yeah. So in a sense, those stories that we're doing with them, they just wouldn't have happened if we didn't exist.
Yeah. Our circulation has gone up. You know, there's a hunger for it, but like I said, I'm anxious. In one way, I'm not anxious because I'm making a living. but it gives me a broader anxiety.
Let me take another question. John Mack.
Very quick question. You're all dependent on rich men and women, all three of you, to finance you. Is that the future?
Rich men and women.
We are philanthropically funded. We are dependent on the generosity of our funders. But we've also explored other funding methods. So last year we lodged a crowdfunding appeal, and we had, I can't remember the exact numbers, but we raised something like £20,000 through a crowdfunding appeal, and that was for a specific project. And you can see some kind of future for a certain type of project. Obviously, you're not going to have any kind of element of surprise if you're telling the world first, help us fund this. So it's for a very specific type of project that you can sort of harness the power of the crowd. But there is the capability to do that. I found myself wondering, looking at The Guardian with all the Snowden stuff, how many people in Europe and so on would happily, you know, help to fund that work. It seems a bit of a missed opportunity, really. The other funding avenue that we've explored is grant funding, again, for specific projects. But for the sort of day-to-day work, the stories that you're still developing that you're not willing to publish or tell the world about yet, it's very hard to see what other funding models there are, really, apart from the sort of traditional work with a mainstream media organisation or take it out of your philanthropic funding.
I think...
Sorry to interrupt, but we're running out of time, so maybe...
We'll bring us to. Sorry I couldn't take more questions. Is there anybody that's absolutely bursting? Okay, you got there first.
Just a quick one. As you say, we should not write for free. So how could independent journalist who have a good story can get paid to take a story out there?
Give me a call.
Stick with that one, please.
The perils of investigative journalism, obviously, the McAlpine report was a total disaster, and we had a change of management at the Bureau that was obviously extremely damaging, and it's taken us over a year of consistent reporting aiming to win back trust, and that's all that we can do, is just keep on putting out the most rigorous and intensively researched stories that we possibly can, and you know, gradually we're getting back, but it's been a long time.
Did the job go out too quickly?
I believe so.
I mean, from my side, when I started working with Paul Cook, helped me learn how to do things, and he said everything you write is defamatory, or don't bother, there's no learning point. So make sure that you have the defence of truth. And truth is only a defence against defamation. It's not absolute, is it, as far as I understand, but at least it's an attempt to just make sure it's true. That's all. How you do it, that's journalistic technique, but that's, you know, that's it. Of course there's an investment that you lose, and that's frustrating, but, you know, that's the job.
It's better to bury a story sometimes than to go again.
But what a fundamentally inspiring approach to investigative journalism, good old footing. Closing thoughts. We did start 10 minutes late, you know.
Yeah.
Just going back to the funding question, I think that the kind of business model for journalism has, if not totally broken, it's breaking down. And I don't think there is a silver bullet solution to this. I think what we're looking for is lots of different funding models that will sustain lots of different kinds of things. Now, the philanthropically funded route that ProPublica adopted, of course, it has its strengths as a way of getting things moving. They've certainly done some very good work, but it does raise difficulties as well. The story of Xro's different in that it set out to be a commercial operation. I was actually approached initially to work on a project team that was going to put together a business plan and then go and seek investment. So in many ways, the whole approach was just like any other business. It's just that we were going to be doing investigative journalism, which is a bit unusual. And we went out and found an investor in order to, as it were, get going, to, you know, get some journalism moving and get some stories published. And then it's for us to generate revenue that will, in the long run, make the thing self-sustainable.
Okay. Any final message for these people interested in the future of investigative journalism?
Buy our product.
It's just that there are so many of you.
Yeah, it's fantastic. I think we'll wrap it up there. Okay.